a conversation that we can't use, which is always annoying.
It's the worst.
All right, cool. So the plan on this one is a 90-minute conversation, at this point an 85-minute conversation since we're starting 5 minutes late. And I've put together a little interview guide, but of course I won't stick strictly to that. And it's roughly based on the outline we talked about last time we chatted. And then this will get kind of cut down to probably a 30 to 45-minute episode at the end of the day, in kind of a narrative storytelling format, which I told you about last time.
Yeah, sounds great. Sounds like a lot of work for you guys.
It is a lot of work. But honestly, this is probably one of the most exciting projects I've ever worked on for Fizzle. So I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Nice. Who else are you talking with?
Let's see. So I've talked to you, obviously, a guy named Dave Stewart, if you know him. He's a teacher and trains teachers on Common Core standards and stuff like that.
Awesome.
A woman named Ridu Kular Ralph, who is an international journalist and has won a couple of awards doing that, and now also teaches other people how to become freelance journalists. Andy Perdue, who's a guy who owns a online wine magazine. They publish about 4 times a day, run 4 different wine competitions throughout the year. He's the wine columnist for the Seattle Times, yada yada.
Nice. So very cool.
It's a cool business. Guy named Dustin Lee. He runs a company called Retro Supply Co., I think. Retro Design Co., something like that. He makes retro design resources and packages those up and sells them. Got his start on Creative Market. And let's see. The only other one I've done so far is Claire Pelletreau, Facebook ads consultant. That was how she got her start, and now trains other people to become Facebook ad consultants.
Nice.
Yeah, so good variety.
Yeah, huge variety.
Which is exactly what I was going for.
That's awesome.
Like gender parity and a variety of businesses, and so far we've accomplished that, so that's exciting.
Very fun. And are you doing all the editing, all the work yourself, or do you like recording, then are you passing it off to Chase or someone?
I am doing all of the things. So... it's an exciting learning project for sure. And Chase will definitely help, obviously, especially when it gets to the editing portion of the process. But in the meantime, I'm doing all the other stuff. So it's fun.
Very cool. Yeah. Editing is like both really fun and also just super frustrating.
Yeah, I'm a little scared of it. I know that this first season, especially because I haven't done much audio editing, will feel extremely frustrating. And I'll probably never want to do it again, but every time thereafter will probably be much easier.
Just buy the most powerful computer you can. That'll take away like 80% of your frustration.
I probably need a different computer then. all right. So I want to get going with my first question, which is, do you remember the first time in your life when you did something entrepreneurial?
Yeah, for sure. I sold stationery cards when I was in elementary school. I think it was like Olympia or Olympic or something like that. It was just, you know, back of the magazine, and you could order greeting cards or holiday cards or birthday cards or just sticky notes or pens or whatever. And I would just went door to door on my street and gotten my neighbors to buy stuff. And then I can't remember. You know, you make like $1 per order or something like that, some kind of commission. And then you can either get cash or, you know, like $2 credit for like a bike or something like that. So super, super dorky. But I mean, I was hustling and made a couple bucks. I don't even remember. I think I just got the cash and then spent it on comic books or something.
That's awesome. I love those little stories. They're always so fun to hear. You know, did people have some kind of early entrepreneurial experience, and almost everyone did. Everyone has some version of selling stationery.
It's like the, you know, vacuum cleaner. Everyone already had a vacuum cleaner, so that one, you know, I missed the boat on that one. It's how my grandpa got his start. He sold magazines all through college and then basically paid his college tuition and even like won some awards and got a free trip to Europe and a bunch of stuff like that.
Wow, that's awesome.
So I guess it's in my blood.
So there's a little warm-up one. Now I want to go back, and I'd love for you to tell me the story of how you landed that internship that moved you from Denver to Kansas.
Yeah, so it was an internship with a church out here in Kansas City. So I was going to Bible school in Denver at the time, and wasn't just a huge... My freshman year didn't totally love the time at the school, and just kind of wanted to try something different. So I heard about this internship in Kansas City, and at the time I was a drummer. I played drums all through, growing up. I was a drummer. I was in some bands, did a lot of local shows, and we did some albums and stuff like that through high school. And so in college, I was in a college band and stuff like that. So there's this internship in Kansas City and with the church, and they had a huge focus and emphasis on music. They had a recording studio, was kind of like an ancillary sort of side business related to the church. They did a lot of touring and some conferences and stuff like that. And so I was really interested in that. So I basically applied, and I think they had like 45 spots available and like 46 people applied. So it's pretty much everyone got in, but I think one person is obviously, I guess he didn't get in. So it wasn't super hard. You know, if you apply, you're in. Basically how it worked. And so I came out to Kansas City. That was in the fall of 2011. I actually moved just right after September 11 happened. And so I was came out to Kansas City that September of 2001, and was just going to do the internship, play drums, find a band to be with and whatever. And then ended up really falling in love with the church and the people that were part of the community out here. And started doing a lot of traveling. We did a bunch of conferences and stuff like that. So ended up sticking around. And I'm still in Kansas City like 15 years later.
When you think back to that time of moving from Denver to Kansas City, was there something you were hoping to find in Kansas City? Or was there something you were hoping that would change in moving there?
Yeah, I think so. Growing up like through like kind of in high school, a lot of my friends, I kind of grew up in a smaller town. And so a lot of people, like, we just grew up all, through elementary school. I was in the same class, probably about 20 or 30 of us were, from kindergarten all the way to graduation together. And had several friends through high school. And so as we're, you're just thinking about like, what are you going to do? Where are you going to go to college? What do you want to be and stuff like that? And I really wanted to be involved with some sort of church stuff and either as a musician or, maybe I was going to be a pastor. I didn't know. But something along the lines of church. And so that's kind of why I went to Bible school, because it's like, well, if you're going to do something in church, you go to Bible school. And it just wasn't quite a fit for me. And so I think the idea of moving to Kansas City was hoping to find a place that would be a better fit for just, preparing me to work with a church for the rest of my life was kind of my expectation. And so I think like hearing some of the people that had been through this internship in Kansas City already, and just the idea that there was a strong emphasis on the music stuff, which I loved. I was a musician my whole life. And so there was a lot of draw and connection there. My hope was I'd spend a year in Kansas City doing the internship and then would go back to Denver. And instead of returning to school, I would return and maybe find a church that I could start, at the ground level and start working for a church or doing something like that. But instead, I ended up kind of staying on at the church in Kansas City instead of coming back to Denver.
Was there something that, what did music represent to you at that time or just in your life in general? Like, what did music bring to your life?
Gosh, it was like everything. It was massive creative expression, a lot of community. I loved playing in bands. I was in a couple different bands through high school, and one band in particular, we did a lot of local shows. We recorded a couple albums, and so I guess, by like high school standards, we were pretty great. I listened to some of our old tracks. We're actually, my wife and I are in the process of moving right now, so we're cleaning out a bunch of stuff around the house, and I came across one of my old CDs. It's got to be like 18 years old now, and it's just It's terrible. It's so bad. And I'm like, in my mind, I thought we were so great. And now this is awful. But you know, the community and being part of a band, and these are like your closest friends, you're writing songs together, you're making music, you're traveling, you're touring. Even though, I mean, we never went super far, but we did a lot of local shows and some festivals, in Denver and in Douglas County Fairgrounds and stuff like that. And there's just a lot of just energy and excitement and fun kind of around that scene that I really enjoyed. And even through college and then moving to Kansas City and being part of a band and did some more albums in Kansas City and toured quite a bit. Actually ended up touring the whole country. We did about 30 conferences or so while I was the drummer and ended up being the stage manager. So just that whole world when, you know, just the recording studio stuff, mixing, mastering, all of that from, you know, writing songs to performing them to recording them, album, you know, the artwork, all of it. There's just something cool about that scene that was just my life for a long time. The community around it, just the creativity. It's a lot of fun.
So when you think back to that time of, well, I guess even before I asked that, like, what did it feel like to get or to be paid to tour around and play the drums, to do music as a living, essentially?
I was blessed. It was super fun. The guys that we were in a band here in Kansas City. And you know, everyone in the band was in my wedding and we were in each other's wedding. So we became really, really good friends. Obviously we still are actually really close friends. I was actually talking with one of the guys just this morning. And so there was just something, you know, it was a blast. And we had a whole crew and we would do these conferences. We did a lot of stuff with kind of the college age demographic. And so we would go, you know, we were in Dallas and LA and we did a lot of stuff in Rochester and Chicago and we did a few shows up in Canada and just, you know, kind of going all around and you're getting to meet people all around the country. And we would do these events and it wasn't so much like we weren't going and doing like a show in terms of performing like a band, you know, like a regular music band, like you would think of, like we were doing songs and stuff like that, but it was also conferences. And so we would perform and do our stuff, but there would also be like teaching and it was kind of like a Christian conference. And so there was the stuff that kind of, it was a whole weekend event and Friday night sessions and, you know, Saturday during the day and stuff like that. And so just getting to connect with college age kids around the country and meet with them and just, you know, getting to meet other people that were doing stuff, just a lot of fun. And then, you know, just getting to travel with your bros and your friends and the work that went into it, and it was these, you know, long road trips, setting up the venue and all the music gear, and we ended up doing a bunch of like technical stuff. We had like the keyboard player and myself both used laptops to run a lot of tracks, and we used click tracks and stuff like that. We all had these in-ear monitors, and so we had a whole AVM system that we would travel with and kind of ran our whole monitor system. And so there was a lot of fun, just the engineering behind that and setting it up. So the whole time, yeah, it was, you know, about 10 years or so that I did that. It was a lot of fun, just working with those people, getting to meet people, it was just cool. It was a really good time. Something, you know, especially when you're younger, you don't have kids or anything like that. It's traveling can be a lot of fun.
Is there a particular like story or conversation from that time that sticks out to you as kind of representative of what it was like doing that for a living? Like a particular show or like,
yeah, there was a lot. I mean, everywhere we would go, there was one time we went to Tallahassee, Florida, and the venue was just a local church there. And so we brought our whole AVM monitor system, and kind of the way it would work is we had this, you know, all these big boxes. I don't know if you can imagine like the big black boxes with the chrome corner, silver edge pieces and, you know, the airplane stuff. So all these flight racks and all the stuff. And so our AVM monitor system, basically on the back, it had all the plugins for the XLR cables or like the microphone cables. And so we took everything, the way it would work is would come in and we would unplug all the front of house cables and plug those into our AVM system. And then we brought our own extra set of cables to then plug to go out of the AVMs and back into front of house. So that way we had all the channels from the stage went through our AVM system. So we could just, you know, plug in our in-ear monitors super easily. Just we took that everywhere we went. So we went to this church, and their whole front of house system was all underneath the stage. And we started unplugging stuff, and like it was so old, like things started breaking in terms of like we were there. It usually took us about 45 minutes to set it all up, and it spent like 7 hours. And so like everyone went out to eat except, you know, me and the other guys that did all the technical work. So everyone's just gone. They're sleeping, and we're there till like 2 a.m. trying to like repair stuff, fix the front of house stuff, get it all working again. And in the end, it actually didn't even work. We had to use just their regular monitor system. So there was, you know, times like that where you're just going, you're working, and you have no idea what you're going to encounter. Or sometimes you go somewhere and they've got something that's even better than what you have. And so you just get to work with them. And it's just fun kind of meeting the different sound engineers at the different places. And like, these like front of house sound engineers are very, very particular. It's like, whoa, don't touch my stuff, bro. And there's just a lot of, it can be territorial, but sometimes in a good way, I guess. So it was always interesting. You never know kind of what you're going to encounter. Or like one time, this is super dorky. I'm having like flashbacks of like our early stages before we were using laptops. We were using just a CD player. This is like 2002. And so we just like went to a friend's house. We get on his computer and he has all these loops on his computer and like, oh, this is so cool. So we record one of the loops. It's just, you know, background, just kind of drum beat track kind of a thing that just kind of loops over and over and over. And we record like 20 minutes worth of it onto a CD. And we're like, okay, we're going to use this for one of our songs. And so we go and we were playing at a larger venue and they've got, you know, all the subs. It was one of our bigger events that we did here in Kansas City about once a year. And so, you know, all the subs underneath the stage and we have our little CD player. And so like, you know, we hit play on it and just at our little church, no big deal. Like you hit play, the little drum track starts and, you know, I'm listening to it. And so I'm playing along with it. But here at this bigger event, we've got the CD player and then the subs are like literally bouncing the stage. And so the CD just like starts skipping and it's skipping around and it was just kind of incredibly embarrassing. Just, you know, I mean, it was only during sound check, so I guess it wasn't 10,000 people didn't experience it, but we, you know, we were trying to be professional in front of these sound engineers that are helping us get set up and we've got our CD player. So they're like hunting around to find foam for us so the CD player doesn't skip. I don't know. I guess it's not that funny when I tell it, but that in the moment it was embarrassing.
No, that is amazing. I love that story. That's a perfect little contrast to the other one, too, of just, you know, spending 7 hours of setting your stuff up and then ultimately having to default back to just the what they had on hand. Yeah, that's awesome. So at some point during that time, you started dating a girl from Denver and you were dating long term and that turned into getting engaged. So how did that change? How did meeting a woman that you knew you wanted to marry change the way you looked at the work you were doing, or did it?
It didn't. Like my wife, Anna, yeah, we dated long distance for a couple of years. And so she was a singer and she plays keyboard. She's a songwriter. So we actually kind of met through the music scene as well back at my church in Denver. So that's kind of how we met. And so you know, the work I was doing with traveling and playing drums and being part of the church in Kansas City was actually, you know, we saw eye to eye on quite a few things, which was great. So it was sort of like it didn't really change my perception of the work I was doing other than it was, I mean, dating long distance. She was going to college in Boulder, Colorado. So it's, you know, 9-hour drive between Kansas City and Denver. And so that was hard. Dating long distance was, I think, the most challenging part. But in terms of my approach to the work I was doing, my approach to the, you know, being stage manager and drumming and work with the band and all that stuff, she was, you know, she loved that world. She loved that scene. So we had a lot to talk about and that was kind of, we had a lot of common ground in that regard.
Yeah, that's great. So How did your life change after being married as compared to before?
Well, I went from being like a bachelor to now suddenly, you know, someone that knows how to clean the house. That was a huge, huge change. Like I, you know, I had a bunch of guy roommates and we were renting a home that my parents had bought kind of as an investment real estate property. So I just like kicked out all of my guy roommates. And then my wife and I were just renters from my folks for a while until we ended up just buying the place. But I think the biggest change was just the difference between being like a single bachelor guy and then now, you know, being a married guy and just the, you know, just going on dates more often and having just, you know, clean up after yourself and do your dishes and, you know, pick your underwear up off the bathroom floor kind of stuff was probably the biggest change. And it was cool. Like she moved out to Kansas City and so she joined staff with the church as well. So we actually had a very similar schedule. So we spent a lot of, you know, the first couple of years of our marriage, we actually spent quite a bit of time together, even at work. Like we had a very similar schedule. So we would commute to work together and had similar hours and commute home together. So it was really fun. It was kind of a really cool time those first few years of being married and getting to know each other more and stuff like that with the overlap of schedules and responsibility was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, you're not still a musician, so obviously that changed at some point. And I think one of the things that started to change that was you started doing some freelance design work. So tell me the story of how you ended up landing your first freelance design gig.
Oh, man. Okay, so with the drumming, right? So I have the MacBook 12-inch, you know, PowerBook G4 was the first Mac that I bought. And this was back when it was like if you had to do real work, you bought a PC. But if you were going to do something with graphics or music, then you would buy a Mac. It was kind of like the perception back in the day. And so I bought the little 12-inch PowerBook G4. And I used it to run a lot of the loops and the click tracks and some of the stuff for when I was playing drums. And so I'm like, well, here, I've got this Mac. I might as well just get Photoshop and start to learn Photoshop. And so kind of spent my evenings and weekends sort of dabbling in Photoshop and just doing, like, to me, the greatest thing you could do as a graphic designer would be designing, like, album art for CDs and stuff like that. So I just did all these. I would just make, you know, I had fake artists that I made up and fake album art and, you know, ugly stock photos that I would try to like turn into album covers and stuff like that. And just dabbled in that quite a bit and was terrible at it. But like I had Photoshop, so thus I was like a graphic designer. And so obviously, you know, people hear that you have Photoshop and they're going to go, hey, can you make my book cover? Can you do my CD cover? Whatever. So I started doing some pro bono stuff just because I was so bad. I felt guilty charging anyone for my work because it wasn't good at all. And so I did a few CD covers that turned out pretty cool in the end and was getting help from some of my friends that were far better at Photoshop than I was and doing actual design layout. And I mean, there's so much more. Like to me, I was like, man, once I can figure out layers and layer masks, like I'm done, right? Like that's it. I had no concept of, you know, like balance and typography and like color palettes and or anything like that. I just had no concept. You just slap it on the Photoshop file and it was good, was kind of my mindset. So I learned quite a bit dabbling in that. And so then I got hired to do a book cover and it was like the first time that I was charging for, I think I charged like $75 for this book cover. And I like presented, I go, here you go. Like I designed it over the weekend and I sent it to the guy and he was like, well, I don't like it. Can I see some other options? I was like, oh crap. I just spent my whole weekend doing this book cover design. And so then like I went back and forth. We ended up having like four or five rounds of mock-ups and changes. And then every time I was like, well, if you want another one, that's going to be like 50 more bucks for that. Then they wanted to do some photos. I'm like, well, okay, maybe like 50 bucks for the photos. And so in the end, I ended up charging them like 300 bucks. And I got this, you know, he pulled me aside kind of at the end. He was like, hey, why don't you just charge me 300 bucks at the front? And then you've allowed for this kind of the fudge room. And then also he goes, I don't have to feel like I'm inconveniencing you. And so I learned a ton working with this guy. He was a really good businessman. And so he knew a ton about how to negotiate, how to just communicate with clients, have a kind of more of a giving attitude than sort of a like, hey, Mr. Client, you're like super inconveniencing me by asking for all these changes and new mock-up designs and stuff like that. So that was sort of my introduction into doing graphic design. And I started doing a little bit more on the side and And that led into doing some web design stuff and starting my own website just to, you know, like dabble with web design and also just have a spot where I could write and publish it and things like that.
Yeah. So, you know, we kind of say that kind of thing flippantly now because, oh, obviously you would have a website where you write and you share your work and all of that. But really at the time that you started your site, that wasn't quite as commonplace or as an assumption as it is today. So what made you decide to build your own site and like, what was that like? That was probably 10 years ago, 8 years ago, something like that.
I was actually 12 years ago,
yeah, so,
maybe.
You know, that's a long time in internet years. It's like an eternity.
It was.
So what was that like? And like, what inspired you to even think about beginning to write and have a place to store your work online?
You know, it feels like it's been an eternity. I feel like some of the biggest factors around that time, I had a few friends that they all had like Blogger blogs. And, you know, they were writing all the time. And I just like got hooked on reading my, you know, these people, like reading their updates. And they were write, you know, they would write stories or they would write thoughts that they had or ideas. And it was just like, oh, this is so cool. And I kind of was always in the back of my mind, you know, even just growing up, like I considered myself a writer or like I liked the idea of writing. I didn't actually like to write, but I liked the idea of writing and telling stories and publishing my work and stuff like that. And I'd never really published anything. I just had started book ideas, but they never went anywhere. Probably like so, you know, so many of us do. You get this idea and you're like, this would be awesome. And then you sit down to do the work and you're like, this is terrible. I'm done. I'm going to just go eat cookies or something. So just a complete, you know, I never really had an outlet that I could stick to. And so this idea of having a blog where you write a story or you write something that you're thinking or feeling about life. And it was, you know, it wasn't journalism. It wasn't reporting. It wasn't reviewing anything like that. It was, hey, I'm in Colorado with my family and it's Christmas time. And isn't this cool? And here's a picture of like the Christmas tree. So it was very the kind of the introspective journalesque, you know, on the internet kind of approach, but publishing it, knowing that other people would read it and could read it today and then I'll publish the next thing tomorrow and they could read that and that there would be people that could visit the site and read what I had to say on a regular basis. Like something about that just kind of clicked and that became like the motivation for me to continue writing. Sort of like when you're having company over and you are going to clean your house because the company's coming over, there's something about knowing that people are going to visit your site expecting to have something there to read and that they will read it. That was like, that just worked for me. And so I just started writing regularly. Basically just one day I started a blog and then I just started writing regularly. And so it was on Blogger at first. And then a friend of mine like introduced me to the idea of self-hosting a WordPress website and you could change the theme and change the fonts if you wanted. And you could actually, you know, fiddle with the code and it would just kind of blew my mind. And so I started getting into, like I set up, like I bought my own domain and installed a WordPress onto it. And then, you know, this was like WordPress, like 1.3, I think was where I was at. And, you know, started fiddling with the theme and the typography and just learning about HTML and CSS and, you know, learning by breaking it and then trying to fix it or, you know, seeing someone else's website design and liking that and then trying to figure out how I could make mine look similar to theirs and adjusting it and kind of learning and things like that. And then I started realizing that some people would blog or, you know, they would write on the internet for things that were different other than their personal life and like the sandwiches that they were eating. And they would actually have commentary on events or on products or, you know, companies or things like that. And it just kind of just changed my whole paradigm that I could write about stuff other than me. And so that's kind of just slowly how things evolved into, I started doing reviews of software on my Mac and reviews of like just different products. Cause I thought that was fun. I was I kind of had turned into an Apple nerd from using the PowerBook and all the stuff that I did that with the music and the graphic design and stuff like that. So that's kind of how I got into writing on the internet.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's so interesting now to look back at that with both of us having the hindsight that we have on your story, to see that that was really the beginning of everything as it stands today. But it was just kind of, it sounds like a side project at the time.
Yeah, it was totally a side project. It was just it was half creative expression, half like ego. You know, like you want people to read your stuff, and how many site subscribers do I have, and how many people are subscribed to my feed burner, and how many page views do I have, right? And it was like, I remember when I had 75 people subscribe to my feed burner, and I was like, oh my gosh, like this, yes. Like I just felt so good, you know, with 75 people. And yeah, I mean, hey, that's kind of cool. Like there's definitely something there, because it's, you know, you want to write for an audience, and when you've kind of got a grid for the fact that people are reading, there's definitely some motivation there. But it was also like there was just a lot of ego involved, which, I mean, I guess every artist needs a little bit of ego. But it wasn't just, you know, pure creative expression for no other purpose than to give, you know, flowers to the world or something like that. Right. There was definitely some ego stroking.
Yeah, of course. So when you think about beginning to sell your skills as a designer around that time, what did it feel like to use a skill other than your musical talent to begin to earn money to support you and your wife?
That's a great question. I felt completely like not qualified, you know, very like imposter syndrome, not qualified. Like I had never, because I never went to design school. Everything that I knew about graphic design was pretty much entirely self-taught. I really had a hard time coming up with original ideas on my own. I had to go find inspiration from other places, which now looking back, it's like, well, sure, of course you're going to find inspiration from other places and then take that and make that your own and create something unique from the inspiration. But I just felt like I should be able to go into a room and just like stare at the wall until I had this brilliant original idea for something that was unlike anything that had ever been done. And then I would just design that thing, and here you would go. And so I felt, you know, I just didn't know the world of graphic design at all. So I felt very much, yeah, just not qualified, very much imposter. And then also I just hated the work I was doing. I loved the process of the design and layout and trying to solve problems, you know, communicate information, or, you know, we would do, I started doing brochure stuff and flyers and did some more album artwork. And just was never felt super proud of the work that I was doing in terms of like, yeah, this is great. You know, I never felt incredibly proud of it. As opposed to drumming, which I'd have been a drummer for, you know, at that point in life, you know, we're talking about 2005, 2006 now. So I've probably been drumming for 15 years on a consistent basis, and, you know, 10 years as like semi-professional, if not professional drummer for part of that time. And so I felt as a drummer, I felt like I could go into any situation with any band, and I could sit down and I could play, and I might be nervous, but I knew that I could show up and I could do it, and I wouldn't be afraid. I wouldn't be, you know, scared. I didn't feel like a fake. I was like, yeah, I'm a drummer. I can show up in just about any spot. Whereas with graphic design, I felt like I just had no idea what I was doing. I didn't feel confident in my skills. I didn't feel proud of the work that I was putting out. I always felt like it could be better. It could be better. And so that was really challenging, I think, of just kind of fighting through those early years of, you know, as a freelance designer. I was doing very, very few paid jobs, and I wasn't charging very much. So I wasn't on the scale of, you know, like when I think of that freelance designers that are great, some of my friends that I've met online, like Tim Van Dam or Sebastian DeWitt, like some of these guys are incredibly talented, and their freelance work landed them gigs, you know, working for, you know, Dropbox or Instagram or whatever, and these amazing jobs. I wasn't anywhere. Like when I say I was bad, like I really was bad. Like I was bad. Like the guy, you know, like that we make fun of, who is like, oh, my nephew can do this in Microsoft Word for like $5. Why can't you do better? Like I was the nephew doing it in Microsoft Word for $5. Like that's the skill level that I was at. So it was really hard to actually be doing work, also knowing that it was really crappy work. But I was doing it, so I guess, you know, whatever.
That's hilarious. Okay, do you mind if we take a quick restroom break and I'll come back in like 2 minutes?
Sure, not at all.
Yeah, I just had a big cup of coffee this morning, so give me 2 minutes. All right. Sorry about that. You there?
Yep.
Cool. So I love this idea of you having built all of this expertise as a drummer and then basically going out and having this like complete beginner's mind and just kind of finding your way as a freelance designer. And meanwhile, you're taking all of that and you're also writing at the time. And I just think it's fascinating that you had these three different kind of creative outlets of music and design and writing. When you look back at that, was there, do you see a connection between those in your work?
In terms of like, do they connect now, like the, to where I'm at today, or do they like back then when I was kind of doing all of that at the same time? Cause I was sort of, you know, blogging for fun, freelancing on the side, but yet still drumming to pay the bills. I don't know if they were connected back then. To me, like a lot of it was just, it was all life. Like it was a lot of the graphic design I was doing was, you know, some of it was for the church itself. Like we had a camp in the summertime, for kids. And so I designed like the flyer brochure, or we were having like a conference or something. So I designed one of the posters. So like I was just doing the graphic design. I guess the connection was it was my life. I was like the world I was in terms of all of my close friends, all the people that I was, you know, traveling with, the people I was around all the time, the church that I was working for, all of that. It was like the drumming, the graphic design stuff was kind of part of that world. And then the writing was just me just kind of having fun and also just building an audience. Like it was really enjoyable to try to build an audience and get people to show up and read your stuff on a regular basis and write something that was interesting or funny or compelling or helpful for those people on a regular basis. It just kind of got addicting, honestly. Like the idea of writing for an audience on a regular basis, it just started to source, it like gets into your brain, and like everywhere you start to go suddenly becomes, oh, I could blog about this, like, or, oh, I should, you know, I should write about this online or something like that. Right. And I mean, now it's kind of grown into like, oh, I should tweet about this or Instagram this or Snapchat this. You know, but in the early days it was like, I could blog about this. And so it certainly like that starts to just kind of go everywhere with you. Like that idea of this is a story that I could write about, or this is an experience I could write about, or here's a thought that I could write about. And it all kind of just becomes fodder for the blog and for writing.
Do you feel like there's something in you that's fundamentally different from other people that allowed you to be willing to what a lot of people would consider to take risks as far as trying new things and kind of testing your limits and new practices? Is there something different about you than most people, or like what allowed you to even open up to that possibility?
I don't think there's something fundamentally different. I think it's a choice, right? Like taking a risk is it, you're choosing to take that risk. And so I think the only thing that's different about me versus someone that didn't take the risk is that I chose to, and then I did, as opposed to someone that didn't choose to, or, you know, was afraid to, or didn't even, some people, you know, maybe they don't even see the opportunity. And so maybe that might be it. But in terms of some sort of skill or talent, you know, not at all. Like, I think it's just, you know, I mean, I was a terrible, terrible graphic designer, terrible, terrible writer. And just through brute force of, I kept designing, I kept writing over and over. And I'm still not a good designer. Like, even to this day, I now when I need website stuff, I try to find someone who actually does that for a living and is far better at it than me. But just through, you know, doing it constantly and writing all the time, I got a little bit better at writing. But there was never like a natural talent for me. So I think the biggest thing is just making that choice and going for it, and then having the tenacity to stick with it when it was hard and when I wasn't very good at it and all of that for years.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting about it to me is that opening yourself up to those new practices, these new skills, ultimately led you on a new path. And your design work kind of led to this role as a creative director. So tell me the story of how you turned that initial personal interest in design into a pretty big role as creative director.
Yeah, it is kind of a huge leap. And even just thinking back, I'm like, oh my gosh, like, what were they thinking? So, yeah, so I'm doing all this graphic design stuff on the side while I'm playing drums. And then I get offered a job to basically work for the design and the marketing department on a regular basis. So instead of drumming, like, come over here and do graphic design instead. And it just, you know, I kind of felt right. Like, yeah, this sounds fun. This would be a cool change in seasons. And so this was 2007, I think, I get asked to do this. So I'd been in Kansas City for, 6 years and what, you know, had just been drumming all the time and that was it. And I was like, yeah, let's do the, I was doing the graphic design stuff on the side for like 2 years at this point. And so they said, hey, instead of us kind of freelancing you on the side, why don't you just work for us, full-time instead in this other department? And so I decided to go for it. And, that was a lot of fun and I learned a ton. And I was in that spot for about 6 months as just basically like literally I was like the junior print designer. And there was, there was another print designer, there was the actual creative director at the time, and the marketing director who was kind of over the whole department. And the way that our church worked was that the marketing department was like basically, you know, if it had to do with graphics or some sort of like, communication medium, then it was under the marketing department. It wasn't just advertising. And really, we didn't even do that much advertising. It was more like the design team and the communications team as opposed to the marketing team, because we weren't doing real, you know, real life marketing. But though technically now that I know more about what real marketing actually looks like in terms of content marketing and building a loyal readership and building true fans and building an audience, what I've learned for doing that for myself, you know, also can apply for a company or a church or a large organization. I didn't know that at the time. So anyways, all that to say, come in as I'm a junior print designer and though I didn't know what I was doing in terms of the graphic design stuff, I was getting better. I was getting proficient. If the creative director would say, here, come do this type of a design, I could, you know, fill in the pieces and stuff like that. And I could update old designs with, you know, new content and stuff like that. So then when my boss, the marketing director, she was getting ready to have a kid and was stepping down from her role, they asked me to take over because I had been part of the church for so long. I'd been there for 6 years. So I wasn't super talented as a designer, but I had a lot of seniority in terms of being part of the church, being around. And I had been leading a lot in the music area. Like I was a stage manager. I did a lot of leadership and management stuff with all the conferences. So I had experience as a manager, just not super talented when it comes to actually doing design work. So I guess they thought that I would be a good fit for running the whole team. So I took over. There was, I think there was like 17 of us at the time. And so I went from being like the new guy and the junior print designer to literally being the boss of the editorial staff, the web team, the print team, and like, you know, developers. We had web developers, we had the web designers, we had print designers. And like, I just went from like the new guy to now I was in charge. And that was a challenging transition for everybody. A lot of people thought that they probably should have been given the job, and I don't know why they gave it to me, but they did. And so there was a lot of internal dynamics and a lot of, I don't know, it was interesting, but it was, I don't know, now I'm kind of like rambling.
No, it's good.
It was a huge transition.
Do you remember the conversation when they kind of offered you that bigger role?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember there was two parts. There was actually the initial conversation of, my boss called me into her office and she was like, hey, I'm leaving and I think you should take this job. Are you interested in it? And I was, you know, I was a young guy who was like, absolutely. Like I want to be, I can be in charge. and have some control and get to be the boss. And there was, you know, I'm very type A, I'm very extroverted. So that was like, yes, like I was super excited. And then there was a, I don't know how long the process was. It was a few months that I did some kind of interviews with more of, you know, like the board of the church, because this was a huge a spot. I was in charge of one of the primary departments. Like the budget was, you know, like a couple $1 million budget that I would be over all of that. I'd be over the staff. So there was a kind of a, not a super rigorous interview process. So there was definitely some rounds of interviews with other leaders from around the church and different things like that. And then it was actually the 2-year anniversary for my wife and I, maybe it was our 3rd anniversary. I can't remember, but we were on our way to St. Louis from Kansas City. We're going to spend the weekend in St. Louis for anniversary. And like, we're driving, you know, east on I-70 and get a phone call. And they were offering me the job. They said, yeah, if you want it, it's yours. And so I remember like those two conversations very clearly, like the initial offer and then the actual, like, hey, it's yours if you want it. And so obviously I said, yes, I was super interested. And that was in the spring of 2008 that I took that job.
Do you remember being in the car and like hanging up the phone and what you said to your wife?
I do. I remember being in the car. I remember hanging up the phone. I don't remember what I said to Anna. I think it was something like, you know, like, hey, they offered me the marketing position or whatever. And it was going to be a huge change. I was going to start making a little bit more money. I knew it was going to be like everything that I've been doing, it was now completely different. Now I was going to be going to meetings, instead of, you know, doing whatever, like real work. I knew I was going to be working way more hours and, you know, be around a lot of the senior leaders. That was exciting. I don't remember exactly what I said, but something like, I got it, or, you know, they offered it to me, or here we go, or something like that.
What did that feel like?
It was exhilarating. I was really excited. It was a lot of responsibility. As a young man, I was excited to have the leadership opportunities. I was excited to be around a lot of the senior leaders that I had known from a distance, because the church I was part of, it was a large ministry, hundreds and hundreds of people on staff. We would have these conferences at the end of the year that, you know, 20,000 people would come to. So there's a large scale to the church. And so a lot of the senior leadership of that church, like I had only known them from a distance, but never actually had, you know, spent time with them behind the scenes and in these backroom meetings and leadership meetings. And so I was really excited to actually kind of be a part of that kind of quote unquote, like that inner circle and be around those people. And so there was like this rush of like, I'm going to get to like learn from these guys, be a part of these guys. And then, you know, coming back to the ego thing, like there was definitely some ego involved with like, yeah, like I'm special or I'm cool or someone likes me. You know, and that obviously like that feels good. And that's not like, that shouldn't be like a driving factor for the decisions that we make, but there's definitely, you know, it feels cool. Like you want to be liked, you want to get picked. And so that was like a season in life where I got picked. And it felt great. So there was a lot of excitement and kind of just looking forward to that new season and all the change of responsibility and things. And, you know, I was going to have a ton of autonomy in being able to make choices and decisions and how I spent my time in my own schedule, but also just how I was going to be able to build up the department and make changes and lead stuff. And I remember like the first book I read was Jim Collins, Good to Great. And he just talks a lot about just building a healthy team dynamic and healthy work culture. And so that was kind of like my first year mission was really getting this awesome, healthy, awesome, exciting, you know, work culture for the team and the department. And I was looking forward to stuff like that.
So, you know, you mentioned that there was a little bit of contrast to that in making the transition, that it was maybe more difficult than you might have expected. Was there a story that represents kind of that period of transition into the role?
There was, yeah, I mean, there were several stories. And I think a lot of the challenging transition parts for me was the trying to figure out like the culture that we wanted to have as a team. And like I said, there was about 17 of us, and we ended up growing to about 23. And just trying to figure out like how to be more productive and more efficient as a team. And we had, I think, you know, at any given time, we had, you know, 75 or so active projects, and we had about 30 internal clients. And so we had a lot of stuff. And I just remember that first year we spent just getting workflows in place, and you know, we signed up for Basecamp, and now we're going to have a centralized project management repository, as opposed to beforehand we used to have everything like on a just giant whiteboard with sticky notes. And it was, you know, it was crude, it was slow, it was often out of it wasn't up to date, stuff like that. So these things, and then different people within the team, like realizing that certain folks were incredibly talented, but maybe they didn't gel well with some of the other designers or different things like that. And then just allowing certain people that had been there for a long time that maybe didn't like the direction that I was trying to take things with the culture and with the workflows and stuff like that, allowing those people to quit. Some people I had to let go. And so there was a lot of challenges just with the dynamics and some of the conflicts and working through that stuff. And like, if you've read Good to Great, Jim Collins talks a lot, you know, a lot about finding making sure the right people are on the bus, but also that they're in the right spots and that they're in the right seats. And so even just moving different people around and having some of that transition, even within the team itself and giving people different areas of responsibility and trying new things. And it took like, gosh, I don't know, it took like a year or so. But then we had this really incredible team where everyone got along well. We had a lot of fun. Like, our productivity went through the roof. Our efficiency went through the roof. The skill, the quality of the work that we were putting out, all of that just grew exponentially, as did we were doing more and more projects. We ended up shrinking back down to a smaller team and just a lot of changes. And there was, you know, there was high morale. It was a lot of fun. So that, to me, like, that kind of represents the biggest shift, was figuring out how to, you know, I had been learning how to do print design for years, and then suddenly I got tossed in and I had to, it was like a similar expression, but now instead of like doing graphic design, I was doing like team design, if that makes sense. And trying to build a team that had workflows that worked well and people that got along with one another. And that the work that we were doing was good, that we were building assets, not just cranking out busy work all the time for whoever asked. And anyone who's ever been part of an internal design team can probably relate to just the feeling like that you're just, you know, you're just at the beck and call of anyone who can, you know, submit a support request or submit a design request or whatever. And it's just like anyone that has any idea of something they want to try, it's like, well, just go ask the designers to do it. And it's like, trying to have more of a structure and almost like developing some sort of like currency within our in-house design team and our internal clients, so that not anyone can just request anything from us at any time and things like that. It was a really, really fun, enjoyable, super challenging time to build this culture that worked well together, that had a lot of fun and was able to serve the big goals of the church, of the stuff that we were doing, as well as helping the smaller departments and the smaller teams with their needs and things like that.
So when you look back at that time of your life, you know, leading a team, not just reading about leadership, but directly applying what it meant to build culture, to build team chemistry, to get people in the right seats on the bus going in the same direction, what role do you feel like that has played now, looking back at it, in helping you become an entrepreneur?
It's a great question. I think a lot of it, you know, learning for me personally how to better manage my time, how to kind of avoid like busy work and be able to focus on, you know, I mean, whatever, like the cliche of urgent versus important. And being part of a large nonprofit organization with an in-house design team, like, everything was urgent all the time. you know, just tons and tons of requests and decisions were made. And a lot of them were emotionally driven. And so there's this sense of urgency on it of like, oh, we got to get this done yesterday. And so like for me, learning how to field those requests that were coming in that were these urgent requests, but maybe they weren't actually important. Or maybe they were, but we already have like 25 other urgent and important requests, and we just don't have the capacity for one more. And so just learning how to navigate those waters and building the culture. And then for myself, like I had a lot of responsibility for, you know, planning and organizing a lot of the campaigns we did for our larger conferences. And like the conferences that I'd had been drumming on for so many years and touring, now I was in charge of marketing those conferences and making sure that people were going to show up. So it was kind of this cool dynamic to be like, okay, first I was the guy that would actually travel to go there to see the people. Now I'm the guy to make sure that when the band gets there, there's going to be people there, you know, they're going to buy conference passes and stuff like that. And so I was in charge of a lot of the planning for that. And I learned quickly that I had to carve out time for my day, and as well for my week. Like I would have Fridays where just a day where I would come home and would work from home on Fridays. I didn't do email. I didn't do meetings. I didn't do phone calls on Fridays. And I would just kind of plan and think and schedule a lot of the bigger stuff so that we had, you know, we had marching orders basically for the upcoming weeks and months in terms of executing a lot of our campaigns and doing stuff like that. And so I learned quickly, like I had to carve out that time to focus on the work that was really important and that wasn't necessarily time sensitive. And that has probably been the biggest contributing factor for kind of me stepping out now and doing my own entrepreneurial stuff. And now that I have, you know, complete autonomy for my schedule and run my own business and kind of report to myself, I still have to make sure I'm carving out that time to do the important work, plan ahead, prepare, and basically generate like marching orders for myself and for the work that I'm going to be doing in the upcoming, you know, weeks and months and things like that.
So, you know, you had this job that maybe looking back now, like if you were them, you might not have hired you for, but you did well in it and you were leading the team and you were managing this big budget and you had some good things going on. You know, your career was growing. And in December 2010, you and your wife experienced a kind of a personal tragedy that would change your direction quite a bit. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been doing the marketing, you know, running the marketing department for almost 3 years. And my wife and I got pregnant in the fall of 2010. And then had a miscarriage in, you know, just right after Christmas and right in between kind of that week between Christmas and New Year. And so this was our first pregnancy, first miscarriage. And it's actually, you know, it's pretty common to have a miscarriage in the first trimester. It doesn't make loss any more challenging, but it was, it just kind of like slowed everything down for me. And I had still been, you know, writing my website on the side all this time, through leading the marketing department. And so as I was learning about team dynamics and learning about design and learning about creative direction and stuff like that, I would just write about it because that was a way for me to sort of synthesize the stuff that I was learning. And so, you know, here we are, you know, just kind of just going through this miscarriage and, you know, just life just slowed down. And was able to step back and almost, it was like this, like a couple weeks where I sort of felt like I was just watching my life, you know, kind of from like 5 feet above and just this, I mean, not literally, I wasn't having any sort of visions or anything like that. I just felt like I had a different perspective and just kind of, as things slowed down, just realizing, okay, what the work I'm doing right now is, I love it. It's a lot of fun. I love being a part of the team. But I was also incredibly busy. I was working usually at least 60 hours a week. Oftentimes I would be working 70 or 80 hours a week. And which was great. I loved it. I loved spending my time, you know, with the church, and you know, a lot of those hours overlapped with my wife's schedule. So we still spent a lot of time together. But then suddenly like we're going to have kids. And I was like, there is no way I can do 80 hours or 70 or 60 even as a dad. I want to be around for my kids. I want to be present. I want to be available. I want to have flexibility as they're, you know, they're going to be playing soccer one day. I want to be able to go to the soccer match. And so I just was like, I need to make a change. And then sort of like the entrepreneurial thing kind of kicked out of me and was like, maybe it's time to kind of branch out and do my own thing. Which wasn't super, didn't feel super crazy. One, because I'd been doing the blog, you know, for, you know, at this point it'd been 4 or 5 years or something like that, that I've been writing the blog. It's 2010. And so I was like, I bet I could, if I could give it my full-time efforts, I bet I could turn it into a full-time revenue stream. And I was already, you know, writing on a regular basis anyways, and had started doing some ads and stuff on the side as the traffic had grown. And so I was, you know, making about $1,000 a month or so through, you know, some sponsorships and advertising and Amazon affiliate stuff and things like that. And so I was like, if I'm making $1,000 a month part-time, I bet if I could give it a full 40 hours a week and really focus on it, I bet I could grow it to, you know, if I could get it to 3,000 a month, that would be, you know, like whatever, I'd be ramen profitable by then. And so I was like, I know I could do that. And if I can get it from 1 to 3, well, then I could get it from 3 to 4 and 4 to 10, or who knows, right? Like the, it's like, if you can do one pushup, you can do 100 pushups. You just, it just takes time. And so the kind of the perspective change, through, you know, being pregnant and then losing the pregnancy, all of that just kind of gave me the, it was like this jolt to be like, yeah, I want to make a change in my life. And I think I want to try doing my own thing. And the blog is like, that's the obvious next step to go. Like there's something there. That's a safe spot. If I'm going to start something new, start my own thing, this is where I should go. And I just wanted to like see, like, could I actually do it? Could I take a blog and make a full-time living as a writer, which like no one was doing this 6 years ago. I just felt like it was like Heather Armstrong, you know, Deuce, Jason Kotke, and John Gruber, like the only people I can think of that I knew at the time that were writing a personal website online as their full-time job. And these guys were like giants. I mean, incredibly, incredibly talented writers and tastemakers. And I was just this dork from Kansas City who, you know, started on a Blogspot thing and was hacking my way around WordPress and stuff like that. But I was like, I don't need to make $500,000 a year. I can make $35,000 a year, and that would pay the bills. And I could keep going if I could do that. And so, so that was kind of the, I was like, I think I can do it. Let's go for it. It was sort of the jolt and then deciding to make that transition.
Do you think all those people you were looking up to at the time would have described themselves the same way, you know, maybe like in a time before then, you know, maybe they had moved on from that feeling of like, I'm just a bozo trying to figure things out. Do you think they felt that way too? Do you think that's just like how everyone feels about themselves?
I do think so. Like, I think the more I mean, at the time, like, you know, obviously like their audiences are substantial now. And so their perspective has changed. But yeah, I think most of us, it's like, I think everyone I've ever talked to, and I actually had the opportunity to talk to John Gruber about kind of his early days as a writer. And he was like, he loved writing. And he was like, why not? Why not go for it? And if you've read through a lot of On Daring Fireball, some of his initial posts that he was writing about, like his, as he was trying to turn Daring Fireball into his full-time gig, you know, he's being very transparent and very honest of like, I'm trying to do this. And if I can just make a little bit more money, I think I could go for it. Would you know, and he did like a membership thing. And I think so many of us that we do feel that way. Like we're not sure what we're doing. We're just kind of fumbling around. We all kind of feel like just dorky eighth graders that are just going to give it a shot. And who knows, maybe it'll work out. Maybe it won't.
So you had this experience that kind of woke you up to something that maybe you didn't know was in you, or maybe you didn't know was a direction you wanted to take, but pretty immediately after experiencing the miscarriage, you decided you were going to start a business. Did you worry at the time that, that maybe you were being rash or that you might regret the decision? Like, did you worry that it was too much of a knee-jerk reaction?
I didn't. Like, I guess I felt that, I was like, you know, I can always just go back and work for the church again. I could always go get a job at Starbucks. I felt that if things with the business didn't take off, then I knew I could find a backup plan, that I wouldn't just leave. We wouldn't be ruined. I wasn't going to ruin our family forever. And then I had like a few, you know, little safety milestones, I guess, that kind of that first several weeks when I had the idea. You know, I sat down, I mentioned it to my wife, and I was like, I think I want to quit doing the marketing stuff. And I think I want to take, you know, my dorky little blog and try to turn it into a full-time income. And so like her initial reaction was like, yeah, I think you should do it. And so she kind of had a supportive, very positive initial supportive reaction, which was huge. So it's like, okay, if your wife says, yeah, go for it, and if you fail, that's okay, I know you'll figure it out. There's like a massive, like that gives you a lot of boldness. So I talked to several really close friends of mine. I talked to my dad, who also has been a small business owner for most of his life, and, you know, said, hey, here's what I'm thinking of doing. And he thought it, he was like, yeah, I think you should do it. I talked to some other friends of mine, some here in Kansas City, other people that I had become friends with online that kind of knew this space, that knew about the Jason Kockys, because a lot of people here in Kansas City had no idea who people like that were. They're like, does anyone write for a living, like as a blog? Like, it was just such a bizarre, you know, very, very few people were doing it. So I talked to some of my friends that knew about those people, and I was like, hey, I think I could do this. What do you think? Here's what the numbers look like. Here's what my goal is. And basically everywhere I turned, people were incredibly supportive. No one raised any red flags. And so I was like, gosh, if I feel like I should go for it and everyone I'm talking to thinks I should go for it, it's like, here, let's go. All right, let's go for it. And so then once the decision was made, then it was like, let's hustle. Let's do this thing. So I decided to do a membership drive and ask people to support me. At the time I was asking for $3 a month, and my goal was to hopefully get 500 people to sign up as a member. Was like my long-term goal. If I can have 500 supporting members, and then it was, you know, I figured that would be, you know, $3 a month, that's $1,500 a month. And then I had my $1,000 from advertising, then that's $2,500 a month. And I was like, man, I'm practically to 3,000, and my goal was 3,000 a month, right? So I was like, I think I could do it. And so I also had people sign up for membership as a trick. But when you signed up for membership, you had to pay for 3 months at a time. So it was $9 a quarter. It was actually the membership subscription model. And then I was like, well, now there's people, when people sign up, I'm getting a 90-day runway, was basically the way I figured it. And I go, by the end of the 90 days, I was like, probably most people will quit their membership, but that gives me 90 days to build up my traffic and build up more sponsorship stuff so I can charge more for my ads. And then replace all the membership income with sponsorship income was like that's kind of how I saw it panning out, was get a 90-day runway, and then everyone would be like, I'm not going to renew my membership. And then they would, but that would be okay because I'd have enough advertising income to take over from the membership stuff. And then I would just continue on being supported by ads. So my goal was 500 people. I announced the membership thing and I had 400 people sign up in like the first 24 hours, I think. It was like this enormous response right away. And I think, I have no idea why people signed up, but I think it was the novelty of it, that holy cow, here's someone who's going for it, who's taking that leap to go do, you know, as an independent creative entrepreneur. And there's something, at least, you know, within the community that I was a part of online, there was like a lot of nobility and excitement when someone makes that leap. And I mean, now there's so many people that have made that leap that, you know, independent creative entrepreneurship is not, it's still just as challenging as ever. If anything, it's more challenging. But it's not as rare as it used to be, even just 5-6 years ago. And so, I mean, obviously you guys at Fizzle know, like, you're, that's your entire business model is helping so many of the independent creative entrepreneurs. And so, like I said, you know, a bunch of people signed up right away, and then hardly anyone, you know, let their membership expire. Like, people were renewing it. And so I basically hit my target income, you know, right, like practically within the very first month. I ended up having 500 people sign up by the end of my initial membership drive. And then also, you know, I made, was able to raise my ad rates, and, you know, hit that $3,000 a month, target, like within the first, I think within the first month, actually before I even had officially quit my job and started writing.
Right.
So,
but, you know, although you hadn't left your job, you had quit, you know, you had let them know you were leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the conversation when you told your boss that you were going to be leaving this, like, this amazing job that you had held, that they kind of took a chance on you on? Do you remember that conversation?
I do. It was funny. It was, I mean, not funny. It wasn't like we weren't laughing, but it was just because he had no idea what I was trying to, I was like, he's like, what are you going to do? Like, what's a blog? Like, he just, like, you just have a concept for what I was going to do. Cause I mean, not like, cause he was ignorant, but just like, I was just, it was hard for me to explain, like, yeah, I'm going to write like on a blog and people are going to pay me to do that. And he was like, are you going to sell stuff? Are you, is it a store? Are you going to start a newspaper? Like, they're just, you know, it was, so it was kind of an interesting conversation. But yeah, so I talked to him, right at the end of January was when I kind of put in my notice. And I gave him 2 months. So all of February and all of March was kind of the runway that I gave them for me leaving. And so I took the month of February for me personally, and I was preparing all the you know, to launch kind of my membership stuff. And so I kind of got a lot of the backs behind the scenes stuff set up. And like Marco Arment had just been doing subscriptions to Instapaper, and that's where I got the idea for 3 months at a time, because he was doing it for Instapaper. He was charging $1, but he billed you in 3 month increments to help save on the transaction fees. And so then it's, you know, only one transaction fee every 3 months instead of one transaction fee every single month. So I kind of stole that idea from him. And then just talked to different people about getting stuff set up for how to promote the membership and things like that. I spent all of February doing that. And then for the marketing stuff, I spent the whole month basically just writing out what my job description looked like and how to run the department. I put together like this 60-page just, I don't know what it was. It like just outlined all of our workflows, all of our criteria for design work, and everyone on the team, their strengths, their weaknesses, just everything. It was like someone could just come in and take this book and just go through it. And ideally, they would be able to just take over my job position based on the information that was in that book and have an understanding for why we were made certain decisions and, you know, why we, you know, did things a certain way and some of the philosophical choices that we had made about, you know, with branding decisions and typography choices and stuff like that, as well as just like in these situations, here's how you should respond. And in these kinds of situations, here's how to respond and stuff like that. So I spent a lot of time ramping that up. And then in March, I announced on my website that I was going to be quitting my full-time job and writing for a living. And that's kind of when I kicked off the membership drive. And then, you know, like at the time we're recording this, it's literally like we're a couple days away from the 5-year anniversary for when I quit. It was actually April 1st, 2011. That was like, that's the day I had quit. And then it was Monday, April 4th, 2011 was like my first day on the job writing full-time for SeanBlanc.net. So it's kind of timely. We're talking about exactly 5 years later.
That's pretty awesome, actually. And what's even more timely is that we're telling the story about how you've built a business successfully, success meaning you're making a living from it, on that 5-year arc that we talk about so much, which I just think is fascinating. But so, you know, we've got a number of questions left. So the first thing I want to ask you is, do you have a couple extra minutes for us to spend on this?
Yeah, I got all morning.
Okay, great. I won't take too much of your time, but I do want to make sure we properly tell your story. as you were leaving, having, you know, that conversation with your boss, you know, he doesn't exactly understand what you're going to do at that time. And, you know, you were kind of blazing a trail, like you said, you know, there weren't that many people doing what you were setting out to do. What did it feel like to know that you now had 60 days to get something started, to launch something? You know, like walking away from that conversation, how did that feel to know there was a definite timeline to this idea you had?
That's a great question. I don't know, honestly. It's hard to remember back. I felt, you know, afraid. I felt nervous. But most of my nerves were related to all of the smaller questions and the little things of how much should I charge for the membership and what should the membership perks be and how am I going to communicate this? How am I going to tell people I'm quitting? How can I compel them to sign up to become members? It was sort of all this, like all the hard stuff was in the details of everything and trying to figure all of that out. But the big picture, I felt really, really excited. I just felt, I don't know. I felt alive kind of. I just like, oh my gosh, here we go. Like, yes. Like I wanted to quit right away. I just wanted to tell the whole world, like, I'm quitting my job. I'm going to write for a living and come read my blog. You know, like it was, I don't know. I just felt excited about it that like, here we go, you know, maybe it'll go well. Maybe it'll totally completely bomb. And gosh, that would suck if it bombed. And that would be really embarrassing because I wasn't going to say, the plan was to tell everyone I am quitting and please support me because if you don't, I'm in trouble. It wasn't going to be, if you support me, then I will quit. Right. It was like, no, I'm taking the leap and I hope you'll take the leap with me. I wasn't trying to ask people to support me first, which I think is a huge, you know, in hindsight, I think that was a huge, it was a wise move. It was a good move to kind of be like, I'm in, I'm going for it. Here I go. Are you going to, would you be willing to join me and, you know, support me a couple bucks a month, as opposed to the other way around. And so I was excited about it. And the biggest concerns were all the little details. How much should I charge for the membership? And things like that. And so I was going to do $1 a month. And then I remember talking to, I was talking with Marco Arment about it. He was like, if you're going to charge $1, you can charge 50. He's like, once you've passed zero, then it's kind of just semantics at that point.
Right.
And so he was like, charge as much as you think you can get away with. So I was like, all right, I'll charge $2. I'm going to double it. You know, like $2 a month was, and I just felt like so audacious, you know, asking for so much money. And then I was talking to another friend of mine, Sean Spurdy, and he was like, $2 is nothing. He's like, if people are going to pay you $2, they'll pay you $3. You might as well just charge $3. So I was like, all right, $3. Oh my gosh. But then it was also kind of liberating because then I went from needing 1,500 people to become members to now I was going to charge $3. I only needed 500 people to become members. And so that suddenly felt a little bit more realistic. And like looking back in hindsight, I probably should have charged like $7. You know, I mean, I don't know. I've learned a little bit about pricing since then.
Right.
So anyways, like that was a huge struggle. And then trying to figure out what the membership perk was going to be. And I was going to do a newsletter at first. And it was going to be members only newsletter. And Daniel Jelka, who runs Mars Edit, and, you know, Red Sweater Software, he's a Mac developer. He was like, don't do a newsletter because if you do this, he's like, your writing is your business model. And he goes, so you want your ideas to be able to spread. You want as many people to visit your website as possible. And writing is your main thing. So he goes, don't put your writing behind a paywall. He goes, cause then that's your best work. You want that to be out there as much as possible. And so he recommended like a different medium other than writing. And so I was like, oh, I should do a podcast. So I had this idea of basically just a members only podcast. You sign up for the membership and then the perk is I do a podcast and you get access to that. And it was going to just be like a couple minutes every day. It was called Sean Today. And I'm actually still doing it. It's no longer 5 days a week. It's now twice a week. And that was like the perk. And that's it turned out to be a really excellent perk was this little members only podcast.
Yeah, that's great. So do you remember waking up the day after you launched the membership and realizing that that quickly you had 400 people opt in to giving you the money that you needed to run this business? What did that feel like the next day?
It was terrifying. I felt like now I've got, it was actually really, it was more terrifying than I remember. It was, or than I expected it to be. Cause then suddenly I just felt like, oh my gosh, now I have to perform. Like now there is expectation on me to write regularly, to be better at my writing. Like suddenly I felt like I needed to be someone else. And it was like all, I'd been writing on my site for, I think 4 years at the time at that point. And it was like, suddenly I felt this pressure that was like, I need to suddenly become better, a better writer overnight and more consistently and write about more interesting things. And like, that I had no history in doing. Like, I'm like, I can't, I'm just, it's only, I'm only 24 hours older than I was yesterday, but I felt like I needed to be 10 years more experienced, in my writing. And so there was a lot of pressure to perform and to write more consistently, to write better. And that was actually really, really, it was hard. It was really hard. Like I didn't have an editorial schedule. I had no idea, you know, that first day, here I am, I'm writing, today's my first day on the job. Like I woke up and like, I wrote that day's article that day, you know? And so it was like lunchtime before my first article as a full-time writer even came out, right? Because I spent the whole morning writing it, and I just had no concept for like planning ahead and preparing. And it was really, really hard for, honestly, for like a year, maybe even longer, of just the pressure to like, and there was no perceived pressure in terms of, or actual pressure. Like no one was emailing me or, you know, tweeting towards me saying like, hey, you were writing more often, or wow, you know, I can't believe I'm giving you $3 a month and you know, you're still writing the same stuff that you wrote about yesterday. Like I never got that. I only got positive, affirming, encouraging stuff from my readership, but there was this, you know, kind of self-induced pressure to create content that I, you know, I'd never before done. And so it was really challenging.
And, you know, I'm sure it didn't make it easier that almost like right on cue, as you were getting ready to leave your job, you and your wife got pregnant again.
So. Yeah, we got pregnant. Yeah, let's see. So it's March, April. We got pregnant in, I want to say, June of 2011 with our now our oldest son, Noah. So yeah, a couple months later, get pregnant with again. Yeah.
What did that feel like? Well, like, was any part of you at that point scared about, you know, the fact that now there was even more on the line?
I don't think so. I think maybe I was just naive about what the practicals of becoming a dad and you know, being a breadwinner. You know, my wife was still, she was still working for the church. So we had her part-time income from that as well. And so things weren't like, you know, we had cushion, like we had, you know, we were saving up our money. We lived pretty frugally, you know, we lived debt-free. So we were in a pretty healthy financial state. I mean, we weren't making a lot of money. I think, you know, making like $40,000 a year or something. So we weren't doing huge. But I mean, that's great. You know, $40,000 a year, you can, that's a good full-time, you can live on that and you can have a really fulfilling life. Especially in Kansas City where the cost of living is pretty low out here. And so, I guess I didn't feel too freaked out when I don't think I felt freaked out at all. I was really excited actually when I found out we were pregnant. I'd just gotten back. I went to San Francisco for Apple's WWDC in 2011 because most of the writing that I was doing, I wrote a lot about you know, Mac software. I did a lot of product designs, and so that was kind of the circle that I was in, was the Apple nerd circle. And so I was like, man, I should go to WWDC. These are a lot of the people that advertise on my website. Are, you know, people that make stuff for the Mac. A lot of the people I write about the software that the people are going to be there, the developers are going to be there. And so I was like, this should be great. So I go to the WWDC event, and I was, you know, in San Francisco, got to meet a whole bunch of really cool people. And then, yeah, I came back, and then Anna was like, surprise, we're pregnant. And it was awesome. I don't know. I was really excited about it. So, and that was part of the, too, like it was part of the reason why I had quit. Like I wanted to sort of set an example for my kids in the future. Like, are they going to, you know, one day they may grow up and they may want to start a venture of their own or do something that's risky. And I kind of wanted to like set a precedent for that, you know, even before they were born, that like I had a dream, I had an idea to start a business, to step out on my own and take that risk. And like I did, I went for it, and knowing that they can go for it too, right? Whether I succeeded or whether I failed wasn't even the issue, that I was willing to take that risk and kind of wanting to lead by example for my kids.
Yeah, I love that. What was a typical day during that first year? You know, you were kind of like in the grind at that point, as far as going from, all right, 0 to 500 members basically in your first month. And you've still got the sponsorship money coming in. So you're like close to that ramen profitable number that you wanted to hit, or right at it, mm-hmm. within a couple months. But what did the work look like for that first year? What was a day in the life?
Oh, it was just chaos. I would just, you know, because I was kind of writing about the Apple nerdy stuff. So most of the work that I did was kind of just following the Apple news cycle. And so I would usually get up in the morning, you know, usually around 6:30 or so, get up, make some coffee, and then, you know, take a shower, go into my office. It's usually 7:30, and I would just sit down at my desk and just kind of just like surf the internet and read about, you know, what was happening in Apple News, read about what was happening in design world for different things, because I still cared about design. And that I'd done a lot of writing about design over the years. So that was sort of part of like my audience niche was in the design sphere. And then, you know, anything cool come out, I would maybe write about it. Or if there was some cool new product, maybe I'd download it and try it out and then write a review about using it. I just had no content strategy whatsoever, just aimlessly, just kind of just trying to show up on a regular basis and write. And so it took me, honestly, it took me a couple of years to sort of get into a groove of finding my own voice as a writer, finding my voice as, you know, what are the areas that I want to write about on a regular basis? What are the things I'm just not going to write about? And it just took a while. And I don't know, I kind of still sometimes feel like I'm figuring it out. It was just kind of showing up every day and hoping I can find something to write about. Some days I did, some days I didn't. You know, linking the interesting stuff that I would find and stuff like that.
So at some point, you had the one site up and running, you were a writer, you know, you could, I don't know if you called yourself that at the time, but you could have certainly, you know, you were making a living doing it.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't like the most extravagant living ever, but that wasn't like, you weren't done. You decided that you wanted to build more. That if you could do one site, you could do another one. So tell me the story of how you decided to start that second site on Tools and Toys.
Yeah, so Tools and Toys was kind of like I had a revelation about Amazon affiliate income. Was one, like that was one side of the coin. And then because I was like, man, every year around Christmas, I would do like these gift guides on my site. And, you know, usually I was making 30, 40, 50, 60 bucks maybe a month on Amazon revenue. And then at Christmas time, I would make like $200. And I was like, wow, like I wrote this article and it was like a Christmas gift guide. And I spent like 5 hours working on it and I made $200. It's like, that's like, you know, $40 an hour. And I just was like blown away at like, this was like a really, you know, great use of my time for making money. And so I was like, I should have a site that was like that all the time. and obviously that, you know, that now there's like entire countries of people and that's what they do. But, you know, to me, I was like, oh my gosh, it was just like this revelation. But also I kind of felt like here I had my main site, it was seanblanc.net, and I had this sort of focused content niche of writing about Apple and design. And I was like, but I have all these other interests. I love to camp. I love to cook outside. I love woodworking. I've got all these albums that I like to listen to, all this other stuff. I was like, what if I had another website that the only agenda, the only content for that site was just cool stuff. It was interesting. It was, you know, whatever. It was tools and toys. And so I was like, this would be awesome. Not only could I write about everything that I think is neat and everything that I find that I think is cool, and I can be more playful with the tone and the voicing of the site, but also I bet I could make some more money. Like I'd be able to sell ads on the site, to be a new site, new traffic, so I could sell ads there and then do the affiliate stuff. So I kind of had that idea, kind of came up with a few initial ideas for the things to post about, reached out to some friends, asked if they wanted to buy like the first different ad spots on the site, and then designed it in WordPress over the weekend and like launched it. And you know, it was like from idea to launch was like 5 days or 7 days or something like that. And now it's still going strong, and I got a whole team of guys now that run the site, deals editor and a reviews editor, and we've got a regular content contributors, and Josh and Chris do a really great job keeping up with all that stuff. So that was the idea. Like you said, like I figured if I could do one, I could do two. And so we did.
And so, you know, you went from idea to execution pretty quick. And then you've got this operating reality. You know, now you've got a team, but then it was you.
Right.
And you've got these two sites to run. What did that feel like to have basically two businesses up and running at the same time?
It was like, it was chaos on top of chaos, right? So now I just had no content strategy originally, and then I had two sites without content strategy. And so I just had to like find stuff every day. And my goal with Tools and Toys was to post 2 to 3 times a day. And I'm just not a fast writer. And so I quickly ran out of ideas. And so the publishing schedule for Tools and Toys like slowed down from like 3 times a day to like once a day to, I think it went to, a couple times a week. To eventually it was just like I just wasn't able to keep up with it on a regular basis and run my site and, managing books, managing sponsors, like all the administrative stuff. It was a massive learning experience. So I got to the point, I think, where the Tools and Toys was still doing pretty well. I was making a few $100 a month. But I was like, man, when I was writing for it regularly, I can't remember exactly. It was making something like maybe $800 or $900 a month. And I was like, if I'm writing for it all the time and it makes $900 a month, and then if I can't write for it at all and it's making like $400 a month, well, maybe I could pay someone. There's $500 a month missing because there's not content happening on a regular basis. So I was like, maybe I could make that money back and I could just pay someone that $500 and then they could keep the site going. And then now I'm creating a job for somebody to do. And then hopefully like now it's a potential for the site to grow as opposed to just, stagnate. So that's what I tried. I found someone and asked them if they wanted to start writing on a regular basis. And they did. And instantly, like the first month, like they made back the salary that I was paying them or their retainer. And, it's just kind of grown since then.
That's awesome. So where in there did you decide to write that first book?
Delight is in the Details. Yeah, I wrote that. I want to say, I think it was in the summer of 2012.
And when was that like in relation to, the first site doing well and then also starting Tools and Toys? Was this after Tools and Toys?
Yeah, so Tools and Toys came out in the fall of 2011.
Okay.
And then, so maybe like 9 months later or so, I wrote Delight is in the Details, and I think it was 2012. It might have been 2013, but I'm pretty sure it was 2012. And basically, like it had started as this little mini series on my podcast. So, I'm still doing the Sean Today podcast for all the members, and I had this idea like, oh man, every day is just a different, it's just this variety extravaganza. I was like, what if I took 5 days of the week and I did like a mini series. And we explored one topic from, you know, five different points of view or whatever. And so the idea was, you know, little design details that delight or something like that. And it was based on kind of this article that a friend of mine, Phil Kaufman, had wrote. And he's a graphic designer down in Austin. And he was like, hey, you know, when you're putting together a website or you're doing something and you inject those little kind of details that don't really change the functionality of the website, he goes, but they're kind of cool. They kind of delight the user. It's like sprinkles on a cupcake. You don't need them, but they're nice. They're kind of delightful. He goes, is it worth it? Is it worth it to put those little moments of delight? And, you know, me being someone who had, you know, been following Apple news and Apple design and Mac software, Mac hardware for a long time, this idea of delight in design is, I mean, it's just, right, like it's part of the lifeblood of Mac and iOS software design is this, you know, the idea of delight and beauty and typography and all this stuff. So I was like, oh, yes, like I want to talk about this. So I was like, I'm going to do this on my members only podcast. And then I thought, like, hey, I could tell people I'm doing it. So then if they're not a member, it might be incentive for them to sign up so they can listen to this part of the podcast. And so after I recorded it, I got a lot of positive feedback from it. I was like, I should turn this into like a 99-cent download. Take the five episodes and just have them available. So I figured, well, they need to be re-recorded because I had kind of recorded them for the podcast. And so I was like, well, I need to re-record them as like their own product. And so like I'm going through I had to go through and take the show notes from the original recordings so that I would have my talking points for doing the new recordings. And I was like, well, I should just take these talking points and just write them out and turn them into chapters. And then I could have a written version of this thing and the audio version. And then I could add more value. Maybe I could charge $2 for it instead of $1. And then I came up with all these additional topics I wanted to write about. So the whole thing just ended up exploding. Turned into a book and an audio book. And then I was like, well, I might as well interview some other designers and that can add value. And then maybe I can charge like $20 for the thing. So that's kind of how that happened. I actually ended up interviewing Chase Reeves, and he was one of the interviews for that thing. A lot of fun getting to chat with him. So that's kind of how it just sort of happened by accident and then just snowballed into the book and audio book and interview series that it is now.
So once you had written that, was that meaningful to you to have kind of written and published a cohesive piece of work and put that out into the world?
It was incredibly rewarding. I mean, after the fact, the first day when it came out, I was charging, I think I sold it for like $29. And this is the first time I had really sold a piece of content. I mean, I guess you could say like I had my membership and the members only podcast, but that was just $3 a month. So I felt like there was very little risk for someone to sign up. Whereas here I'm selling something for $30 basically. And I felt like such a hypocrite that I would dare to create something like this and then charge so much money for it. I just felt like I was literally like depressed on launch day. I felt just like such a hypocrite that I would do such a thing. As opposed to just giving the content away for free. I was like, people are just going to think this should just be available for free. But I chose to stick with the plan. I had committed to sell it at this such and such a price, you know, $29, I think. And so I stuck with it. I stuck with that original plan and I launched it. And I can't remember exactly, but I think it sold like, I think I made like $5,000 the first day. And then over the lifetime of it, that first year, I think I sold another, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 worth. And it was like, just like a breakthrough. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, I spent about 2 weeks working on this thing and then it made a pretty significant amount of money. And then like, once I was done working on it, I was done. Like it turned into this passive income and it really opened my eyes to creating something that had an end point, which was really satisfying. So much of what we do online, like just the content strategy and content marketing and building an audience, there is no end. It's just the treadmill of writing and publishing, which is obviously like there's a lot of joy and fun in that, but there's also It's like you need to just be able to have a finish. Like the product is done. And you started it and you ended it and now it's finished. And there's something that was just really rewarding about I built that book. I wrote it. I recorded the interviews. I recorded the audio portion of the book. And then I was done with it and it was finished. And then I could put it out there for sale. So that was a huge thing. Plus just the idea of, you know, making something and then selling it to somebody and having a product that you sell was just huge. Like it was just this change of mindset for me in terms of a business model.
So naturally, the next step for any sane person who has two websites would be to start a third website.
Naturally.
When you had this idea to add a third website, essentially a third business, onto your, I'll call it a business portfolio at this point, was what I was growing into. Did you talk to anyone you trusted at that time about it before you actually went and built this third site? Did you get advice from anyone before you did it?
I don't think so. I mean, I told people I was going to do it. And I kind of asked for feedback about just the general idea, but I didn't ask anyone, should I do this or not? Like I decided to do it. So we're talking about the suite setup.
What was the thinking behind that? Like where did the idea for this third thing come from?
So the idea was on my website, Seanblanc.net, I would do interviews with people about the Mac setups that they use. And I call it the Sweet Mac Setup Interviews. And, you know, hey, like what computer do you use? What software do you use? What would your ideal setup be? Like, you know, pretty standard nerdy questions to people. And these interviews that I would do were by far and away like the most popular pages on my website. And I had a category archive page for my blog. And you could just see the list of all the interviews that I had done. And that was like the most visited page on my website. And I was like, there's probably a business model here that I could, you know, clearly people care about this stuff. They're interested in it. And so I should just have a whole site that is centered around this idea of like a sweet Mac setup. And so I got some advice from like Jason Snell at Macworld and then Federico Vitici, who runs Mac Stories. And they were both like, don't put Mac in the name. So I was like, all right. So dropped Mac and just called it the Sweet Setup. And the idea was we would have interviews, but also we would do software reviews. But instead of just going like, hey, here's the latest, because everyone, you know, at this point, you know, I think it's the end of 2013. And so there was a lot more people are writing about Apple software, a lot more independent people in the space, which was great. And so I was like, what if we could do something different instead of just writing about every app that comes out and following that news cycle and trying to publish 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day? What if we dove into a category of apps? Because I would get this on Twitter all the time, especially, you know, iOS 7 had come out. And, you know, that's when Apple went from all the skeuomorphic design to the flat design. And a lot of people hated it. A lot of people didn't like the new calendar that came with iOS or this or that, whatever. So I'd get these questions like, hey, what's the best calendar app for my iPhone? Or, hey, what writing app do you use? What do you think I should get? What's the best writing app? And so I was getting questions like this all the time. It's like, well, what if we... That was our approach towards writing reviews of instead of going, hey, here's a review of this app and here's a review of this app and here's a review of this app. And we've, you know, reviewed the 25 weather apps that came out in the last 2 days. You guys go decide which one you want to get. Instead, we would say, you should probably get this one. This one's really cool. And here's why. And just presenting people with like a single choice, which was something that, you know, Brian Lamb at the Wirecutter was doing. And I loved that approach. I loved it. It was so transparent. I felt like you could just be more honest. You didn't have to, you know, like you could have an opinion about something, which I thought was so cool. And so that was sort of the approach. Like, let's interview people, the stuff that they use, but then also kind of try to get down to the nitty gritty and say, if you're looking for a weather app or a productivity app or, you know, gosh, I can't even, you know, camera apps or, you know, group texting or, you know, journaling, calendars. I'm like, we got like 50 or 60 at this point, but whatever, like here, do this one. This is our favorite and here's why. And that was kind of the approach to the suite setup.
And so that was an affiliate model that you were going to run that on?
It was, yeah. It was another affiliate model, except with Amazon. Then now it was going to be with the iTunes store, the App Store.
Got it. Okay, so you know, now you have three sites, and you're in a couple years at this point. So it's not like you're a complete newbie just trying to figure out which way is up. And you probably had someone writing on tools and toys by then. But what was it like to have kind of three projects that were all active? What was it like to manage those?
That's a great question. And it was getting better. I was getting better at kind of ignoring certain business administrative tasks that I realized I didn't need to do all the time. I didn't check my email very much anymore. And I kind of stopped following the Apple news cycle. So now instead, like, we kind of had more of a content strategy, going like, okay, let's do the best, calculator app for the iPhone. And I started bringing more people onto the team. So I had a few more writers at this point. Jeff Abbott was helping me with editing everything that we were doing. Stephen Hackett was helping with writing on Tools and Toys and Sweet Setup. Chris Gonzalez was helping with writing. And so like the four of us were working together more. And so that just allowed for, some delegation, people to help with a lot of the day-to-day stuff. And then Stephen Hackett is not only an incredible writer, he is like an incredible manager. I asked him to just take over as the editor in chief for the Sweet Setup. And he took over for the review schedule and the editorial calendar. And kind of working with our contributing authors, and he just excelled at that. And so a lot of it for me was I was able to kind of in a similar pattern for when I was doing the graphic design and the marketing, and I kind of stepped away from my role as the designer and then became the managing role and now built the workflow infrastructure, managed the behind the scenes, the day-to-day stuff to keep the business running, to keep that team running. I was now, 3 years later, I had now kind of stepped a little bit out of the independent entrepreneur for creative content and was now finding people that could help with that and then helping to manage them, helping to make sure that they had the tools they needed, and empowering them to do the work that they could do and helping them to do their best creative work. A lot of it was, it became more manageable because I had a team, if that makes sense.
And in some ways, you circle back to those learnings that you picked up as creative director. Like those start coming into play here as you're bringing people on to help you run these projects.
Yeah, very much so. Except now everyone's remote. And so we're, emails and, back in Basecamp again. And we were using GroupMe, I think, for a while before. This was before Slack existed.
Right. Okay, so the next major step was that you wrote a second book, or you started a project that you thought was going to be a second book on productivity,
mm-hmm. Right?
And it became much more than that. So how did that project come about, and how did it turn into something much bigger than you originally planned?
So, yeah, I guess I don't know. Maybe this is just how I roll. Like I just had this basic idea of I really want to write a book about productivity. And I mean, there was like a million productivity blogs out there and everyone, you kind of like poo-poo the productivity nerd. But I just felt like I really had something to offer and I really wanted, I really cared about, spending your time well and having kind of diligence towards the things that are important to you. And I was like, I really do want to write about this. And so it started again, this very similar life cycle. It started as part of, a podcast series. So I did like 30 or 40 episodes over the course of a couple of months on my website, writing or talking on my podcast about productivity and time management and goal setting and action plans and things like that and lifestyle vision and values and stuff. And the feedback I got from it was just huge, just incredible. Just, people saying this is some of the best teaching I've ever heard about productivity or whatever. And so I was like, all right, I'm going to turn this into a book and it's going to be called The Power of Focused Life. And so that was the goal. And so basically I started, writing the book And it was, you know, like you said, it started out as a book, and it was like the first draft, I think, was about 17,000 words. And I kind of just wrote everything that I had to say on this topic. I just wrote it all out before I went anywhere else to find anything, any other information or anything like that. And so then I'm like, okay, I got the first draft done. Like, this is everything that Sean Blanc has to say about diligence or whatever. And I go, now I'm going to see what other people have to say about this topic to find out, like, what have I missed? What holes am I missing? Can I communicate this better? Can I glean from other people? Can I share quotes and insights from other books? So I just kind of went to Amazon and just, you know, I mean, Amazon's really good at telling you what to buy. And so I just kind of went to like the productivity category, and I was like, I heard this book was good. And then it's like, people who bought this book also bought this book. And I bought like 50 books and just started reading through them on Amazon. And I would highlight them and like, oh, these are really, really great stuff. I was, you know, reading like Zig Ziglar stuff, like old, some Tony Robbins stuff, like some of these old, like just grandfathers of like the original motivational speakers. And so some of it's like super dorky, but also like a lot of really, really great, just golden nuggets in there. So I'd be highlighting the books and then just putting them back on the shelf and then just move on to the next book. And I wasn't even applying any of the stuff to my own life. I was just like, ooh, this is cool. And then just moving on and not doing anything with it. And it just like struck me one day that people were going to probably do the same thing with my book, that they would buy it, read it, maybe highlight it, maybe tweet about it, but it might not actually affect change in their life. Like, they would probably treat it the same way I was reading these books. And if anything, like, I was treating these books even better because I was searching for actionable advice that I wanted to share and teach other people, yet I wasn't applying it. And so I was like, what if? Because like so often, you know, Barrett, you've probably read some of these books, and a lot of books are like this. You get, you know, you get to the end of the chapter and it's like, and here's the action items for this chapter. Right. You know, go back to page 12 and reread this and then go do that. And you're like, okay, chapter 2. And you just like skip right over the action items. And I was like, what if I made something that it was the action item was the whole point? And then if you wanted to read the chapter, you could, but really you would just learn by doing instead of learning by reading. And it was like this, you know, hands-on experiential knowledge approach to figuring out how to manage your time better, how to manage your energy, how to understand what's important to you in life. And it's like, what if instead of it being the why first and then the what, if it was the what first? And I was like, well, the best way to do that would be to have like a website where you would go through and each day you had something that you had to do over the course of X amount of days. And so like just the whole thing just ended up once again, like snowballing into, instead of it being a book with suggestions hidden throughout the book, it was like all these directives or all these little micro assignments. And they were going to, like, every single one was like as simple and just distilled down to like the most minimum simple possible thing you could do. And then you do something else the next day and then the next day, and they all begin to build and weave into one another. And then they kind of form this bigger picture that then by the end of, you know, you've gone through this journey and now you know how to schedule your time and you know what's important to you and you have goals for different areas of your life and you've got stuff that you can do on a regular basis that's enjoyable and meaningful, but yet also moving you towards bigger goals and bigger picture stuff. And it's like all this stuff that seems so daunting from the outset, but it's like, well, you just start a little small. And so it just kind of turned into this, it turned into what's now called like the focus course. And you go through and it's all these little micro assignments. And then if you want to read more about it, you know, it's like every day that has a video that goes with it and there's like 75,000 words of text, but it's like, or you could just do the little micro assignments and just kind of learn by doing. And then I was also going like, well, hey, if I have this as a website and it tracks your progress as you go through and there's video and text and assignments, I'm like, well, those are all, you know, in the business world, like these are value adds. And now I'm creating something that's even more valuable, presenting it in different ways, structuring it differently. And I'm like, I can charge a lot more than just $20 for a book. I can charge more. So I ended up, this was like the first time where I was just like, everything I've ever charged in my whole life, I never charged enough. I'm going to charge enough for the, you know, so I was going to charge $75. I was like, I'm laughing because I ended up charging $250, but it was like, this was like my big, I'm finally going to charge a lot of money for this thing. And my mom was like, no, you should charge $500 for it.
Whoa.
And I'm like, okay, if my mom's telling me to charge $500, I was going to be audacious and charge $75. So I was like, I guess we'll just meet in the middle. So I ended up charging $250 for it. It went really, really well. We sold a whole bunch of copies like in the first couple of days, and it continues to do really well. And it's been like almost 9 months now since the Focus course came out.
And so you've been on this like interesting cadence of every 9 months to a year launching a new project. And so now you have four of them, you know, four legs of the business, I guess you could call it. So let's bring it to present day. So it's March 2016 right now. How does all this stuff look today? You know, what is the Sean Blanc kind of empire at this point?
That's another great question. It's changing quite a bit, and kind of like with Tools and Toys, the suite setup. I've got, you know, we've got the guys that are writing for those on a regular basis. And then the Focus course stuff, like the Focus course, like just kind of blew everything up out of the water in terms of realizing like there's a demand, like the demand for it was so much larger than I was expecting. Leading up before the course came out, I had people emailing me going like, I know it's not ready yet, but can you just send me whatever you have right now? Because I'm desperate to go through this stuff. I really need help with managing my time, or I really need help figuring out like my life vision or values. And so people were really, really hungry for what the Focus course, offered. And it's nothing unique, like everything within the Focus course you can get on Amazon, you know, for $300 for the used paperback books. It's just presented in a different package and something that I think is kind of more easily approachable. But just realizing like the demand for that. And then also just in terms of revenue, like the Focus course kind of just blew everything else out of the water in terms of the individual revenue streams. And it's almost like, you know, it's what the iPhone is to Apple compared to all their other product lines. It's almost like that's what the Focus course is to the different revenue streams that I have going for Blanc Media. And so just going like, all right, let's double down on this. People are interested, and it's obviously very profitable. And I really enjoy talking about this stuff. I'm really passionate about it. And it really, like it legitimately changes people's lives. It's fun to talk about Mac software, and I love it. And some of my favorite websites in the world, you know, write about Mac software. But I'm also finding that, you know, getting the best calendar app or the best GTD app, like that's cool. But that's just like a surface level trick. And while it's important and while it can really make your life better, it's not going to change your marriage. It's not going to change your approach to, you know, if you have a consumer, you know, you're addicted to credit card, right? Like it's not going to change that for you. And this something realizing like I can help in these areas that really are fundamental to our life. And so for me, like right now, it's just, yeah, we're doubling down, for lack of a better term, on the whole Focus course brand, the Focus brand. And so there's a free version of the course now. It's called The Elements of Focus. And it's about 10 days, and it's got some of the basic videos as part of that. And then we came out with one that focuses mostly on time management, because a lot of people would go through the Focus course and they were like, okay, great, I got all these things I want to do. I'm still struggling with getting my day in order and staying free from distractions. And so we did like an additional class that just focuses on that. And then realizing a lot of people that are going through the Focus course are, you know, creative entrepreneurs. And so we're working on like a business, you know, add-on, like a business module. So basically an entire, trying to just build a whole additional business framework that is centered around, you know, with the Focus course kind of at its core. And then a membership community, additional, you know, podcasts and some newsletter stuff and writing, as well as additional classes that touch on some of the specifics about like time management or entrepreneurship and business, talk a little bit about budgeting, you know, health and things like that, and just kind of begin to expand this out, bring in people that know what they're talking about in those areas. And kind of see where that goes. So that's kind of where we're right in the middle of doing a lot of changes to the website and content strategy and things like that right now.
I love it. So, you know, when you think back about that guy moving from Denver to Kansas City for that first internship. Do you think that kid had any idea that he would one day be running multiple businesses, writing books, and making a full-time living from an independent business?
Not at all. Not at all. Like, very, very different place than what I was expecting 15 years ago. But yet, actually, my wife and I were just talking about this recently. I feel like I'm in the right place. And part a huge part of the reason, like, you know, if I only cared about just having fun with the creative stuff, like, you know, I probably would never have, I don't know. I mean, I love the different things we're doing, but we give a pretty decent amount of the business revenue goes into a nonprofit that my wife and I started a couple of years ago that helps a lot of local missionaries here in Kansas City and in a few other places. And so we like to give, we try to give as much money away as we can. And so for me, it's kind of like that initial like care for being involved in the church and doing things has kind of shifted and realizing like I can show up and do the work and be a part of everything. But now that I'm kind of realizing I can build a business that can generate revenue that can provide for people that are really struggling to make ends meet. And, you know, my wife and I, we were missionaries. You know, when we worked for the church, I did get a little bit of a salary, but it was pretty pathetic. And the majority of our revenue, our salary, we did support raising from people. And so we had a team of people that, you know, supported us, some of them, you know, $20 a month, or some people $50 a month or whatever. And that's kind of how we lived for about 10 years. And that was our income. And so being in that place and just knowing that a lot of these people that do work for nonprofits, and it's just so, so hard to fundraise. And it's, you know, and a lot of times, like, we would spend, you know, months fundraising and so much time just trying to raise money. And then it's like your car breaks down and you got to go do more fundraising and asking for money. It's just really, really challenging. And so that's something that we've really loved with the business, is being able to, you know, set up. We have a foundation that we give quite a bit to through the business, as well as a lot of people support that foundation on a regular basis. And then the foundation gives money to missionaries when they're in those moments of things are tough or things are tight. And things like that. And it's just like, you focus on doing what you do best and we're going to help support you. And so kind of just being like a little bit of a, you know, just kind of helping subsidize some of that income. So it's been incredibly rewarding to do that. And so though it's a very different expression than the guy that moved, you know, 15 years ago from Denver to Kansas City, it's also like, oh, like this makes a lot of sense. And having been in that world for so long, and then now being in the business world and being able to use my business resources to help go back and help the church and the nonprofit world. It's a lot of fun, really rewarding.
You know, and like, that's like a cliche way to put to frame a very important thing, you know, because that's what people want you to say, right? Is like, it's really rewarding and it's meaningful but it's hard, like that's a hard sacrifice. You know, most people don't shepherd resources that way. So what is the driving factor for that? You know, like what gives you the wherewithal to say we should be giving this away?
I don't know. I just love it. Like it's like by far and away, it's one of my favorite things. You know, I mean, you know, there's a couple here in our community recently that had, you know, their car broke down, couldn't afford to buy a new car. We were able to help them buy a new car. And it's just like, I don't know, like that is, it just feels great. And then also knowing that this is going to help them, like they don't have to go into debt to get a new car. They're not going to have to quit what they're doing and go find another part-time job. That's like, they got six kids. You know, like you should be at home with your kids, not worrying about this. Like if I have the resources to help, like why not help? And so it's a lot of fun. It's enjoyable. And I, you know, we just feel compelled to do it. We love to do it. There's a really great story that you can tell through that. And then we have a small team of people kind of behind the scenes that are also other small business owners that help support the foundation as well. So there's like, we have a connection with them that, you know, they feel similarly, like they're like, yeah, we want to give money to this thing so that we can help other people. So I don't know, right? You're right that it does seem cliche to say it's so rewarding, but it genuinely is. And you know, like, we've got such a full life. We got two boys that are just amazing. We got a third one on the way. And, you know, I live, you know, like I, you know, I live in a home that has Google Fiber internet, and I have a iMac computer, and I have a couch, and it's like, what more do I really need in life? And, that's like, nothing's going to make me happier. Like, more stuff's not going to make me happier. But helping other people, like, that financial burden can be so, it'll keep you up at night. It's hard. Like, credit card debt is, it just hurts your soul in so many ways. I mean, not to get all like preachy, but like, it's just hard. Like, it just puts a ceiling on your finances. It can put a strain on your marriage. And it's like, if we can help relieve some of that, it's like, why not? So
is that the point for you at this point?
It's one of the points for sure. It's not, I don't know if it's the point. Obviously, like, I want to create something for my kids to either inherit or build upon or learn from as they grow and then go to their own thing. Obviously I love the work I'm doing, you know, with the Sweet Setup Tools and Toys, the Focus Course, the team. Like, there is, you know, I love the work that we're putting out. I think it's so great. It's a lot of fun. And then, you know, the Focus Course is like, legitimately, you know, I hear from people all the time that it's changing their lives and it's helping them. And there is, and you know, a lot of reward to that as well. So it's all fun. It's all kind of just fits into a bigger picture.
How do you think, you know, looking back now, how do you feel like being an entrepreneur has changed you as a human? Like, how is Sean today different from the Sean that was traveling to all those conferences and playing the drums all those years ago?
I think the biggest thing is, I think, feeling more confident in my ideas, that not that my ideas are necessarily special, but that, like, I know that if I have an idea that I think is going to be good, I can execute on it, and it will probably, you know, it'll probably help some people, and it'll probably make some money. And like, there was like, that's just like an inflection point when you realize that, like, you have control over, you know, over life, right? Like, that I don't know if I'm explaining it really well, but like, that I can write something, or I can create a product, or I can do something that's going to provide value to other people. And there will be a reciprocity to it that other people are going to be willing to pay for it. And so it's like, if everything just kind of fell apart today, I mean, that would stink, but I wouldn't be freaked out. I would know that I'd be able to have another idea, create something else, and provide a value, and know that there's things out there you can do to take control, to help other people, and to make a living for the work that I'm trying to do as well. I think that's a huge shift, that, you know, just the choice to take a risk, the choice to be intentional about the decisions I make, and to kind of just take ownership of how I spend my time and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you ever think back to the impetus for this whole thing, for what the business has become, to you and your wife having that miscarriage and that kind of jolt that gave you?
Yeah, often. I think about it often. Obviously, I think about it every, you know, at the end of every year around Christmas time, just with that being the anniversary of it, but also just kind of realizing that, like, that shift of perspective was so valuable for me. And like, it was definitely one of the, you know, a significant milestone in my life for sure.
Is that a hard realization to come to, that like, that was the thing that sparked all of this, and yet it was such a loss and a feeling of, I would imagine, helplessness?
No, not really. I don't know. I guess it was challenging. It was hard. It was sad, but it didn't feel, you know, it doesn't feel like it was this wasteful thing or like, wow, I can't believe that that's such a tragic experience in life would lead to, you know, what I would consider such a, you know, a great turn of events, you know, and set my wife and I on a path that's now, you know, rich and rewarding and that we love. It's like, it's, shouldn't all tragedy like help us to make a better decision to improve things? And it's like, if they didn't, like, what are, you know, taking those moments that you have clarity or perspective or things are slowing down or whatever, and taking those moments and being able to glean from them, learn from them, make a choice in the moment of clarity, and then follow through, and hopefully our lives are going to be improved. Like that would, it seems like almost like, you know, we're doing right by our lost child by taking that opportunity to reflect and make choices about what's more important to us going down the road.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty special way to look at it. And I think it's maybe the only way you can, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, this is my last question, and we've gone way over, so I'm sorry. But what would you share with an aspiring entrepreneur who maybe hasn't been through one of those life-changing, tragic moments yet? Maybe someone who hasn't had that mirror held up, but they also haven't gotten started. What would you share with them?
That's a great question. And I don't know if there's one answer, but I think that for a lot of times, because I've been in similar seasons again, like as an entrepreneur, where it's like, I know I need a breakthrough in something. I know I need to get moving, but I just don't know what's next. And so sometimes it's like you have that jolt where something just happens to you in your life and you get that moment of clarity, or you get a moment of decisiveness or motivation. But other times it's like you just need someone to help you, like to tell you where to go. And so I would start with finding a mentor or finding community, like a real person, and that you can just ask for help or, you know, get some sort of direction from them, and starting small with like doing something. And it's like, you know, I look back now and it's like, yeah, okay, sure, all these different, you know, like you're calling like a portfolio of businesses or whatever, but it's like, you don't just build all of them at the same time. You got to build one at a time. And even each one, you just build one part of it at a time. And I think it can be so challenging to get past that, like decision paralysis where you, so many options in front of you, whatever. And so for me, like I got through it because life was slowing down for me during that season and those couple of weeks where we're going through the challenges of the miscarriage. And it was just like, there was a perspective change and things like that. But when you don't have that, it's like, you just got to pick something and just let's try this path and let's see what works and see where that takes us, you know, or see where it takes me and see, you know, is there someone who can give me some direction about what the next step should be that I should take, and just kind of taking that first step towards anything, and then seeing where it leads.
I love it. That's awesome, man. That's a wrap on my end.
Cool. Awesome.
Thanks so much for giving me so much time. So generous of you.
Yeah, absolutely. My wife's circling outside.
yeah. You were supposed to be done an hour ago. Get it together.
She's just now back.
All right, sir. Well, thanks so much. I will send the draft episode to you before it's published, just to, you know, make sure you feel like it has good integrity to the storyline and everything. And that should happen sometime. If it doesn't happen before April 21st, it'll be in late May because cool. I'm gone for a month for my wedding. So,
awesome. Congrats, man.
Yeah, thanks.
Enjoy your time off.
I will indeed.
All right.
Thanks so much. Barrett. I appreciate you.
Yep. Bye.
Bye.